Hey everybody, Daniel Gregory. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of The Perceptive Photographer. It's interview month here on the podcast, and I've been really fortunate to have been joined by some amazingly talented artists, writers, and creative people this month. For our last interview of the month, I had the opportunity to sit down and have a beer with Eric Binion, who's had an amazing artistic career and artistic life. He has over 25 years experience in the fine art gallery space. He's also an amazingly talented mixed media artist who's worked in painting, encaustic wax, resin, photography, and has really pulled together, I think, an amazing eye, an amazing sense of what it means to be an artist. This interview started off a little bit differently. He and I were, like I said, out having a beer, so I kind of hit the record button midway through the conversation, and you pick up kind of us talking about what it's like to work with a gallery and some of the areas that people should be concerned with when they're submitting to a gallery, and also what it's like to work with such a variety of unique and interesting artists over his career. We're going to pick this up midstream. It's at the point where he and I are joking about how neither one of us had any money in 2008 during the recession to buy the art we actually wanted to at a particular auction we were at. So let's go ahead and jump back into that conversation.
You know, I think that was probably our first photography connection was over that Kenna that we saw at that auction, because we both were like, we should bid on that. I mean, it wasn't as Japan stuff from Japan, but still that New York photo.
Yeah.
Other than getting to bid up the other people on the floor.
I was just a pole back then. That was the pole days. That's when you guys were buying gas to get me to work.
Oh, that was poor for everybody in the arts back then. There wasn't nobody selling art back then.
I was Poe. He was dancing in cash.
Yeah, from not being an artist. Yeah. there was no sense of, what do you mean artist or poor? I got a lot of money. I'm an artist. I got lots of money. You didn't stop getting art back then, though. How'd you get art from Stephanie and all the other poor artists back then? Because they all needed money. I mean, everybody needed money back then.
Well, like people like Steph, I was given art. But I bought most of my collecting financially was in the mid to early 90s. And then I just collected art from people who were giving me art and purchases here and there. But I took a good 15 years off probably from collecting.
Yeah. It is amazing how if you work with artist. I mean, like I've got, you got one of my pieces on your wall that it is amazing how generous artists are with other, other artists. I think that's one of the things that makes them pretty cool about working on your own stuff too, is that, even if nobody sells with it, it's a chance to talk to other artists and share with other artists. And what's it like to go to Terry's place? Cause I haven't been yet. Lori keeps talking about how I got to get over there. She's just like, every room's got some crazy thing going on.
It's cool. It's got some of his stuff he's collected and just his own art as well. So it's just, and it's just a kind of a memorial to his wife. So motivational and cool to see when you're there.
I think one of the things you and I have argued over the years many times is putting work out there, and you always yell at me about putting my work out there. Why is that important for you to yell at me about me getting my work out there?
Because you're a damn artist and I want to see your art.
You think that's true for all artists? What's the name of that guy who died and they found all of his sketches in his house in New York?
Henry Darger.
Henry Darger. You almost bought one?
I will. Someday.
Someday.
Maybe.
Well, you got no room for it.
I have no room for it. Make room. There's always room. Art collecting 101. There's always room.
If I was going to send some stuff to the gallery, what's the three things I could do that would really piss a gallery, piss you off as a gallery person?
Things that would piss us off? Yeah. Calling the gallery, stopping in the gallery, and those are kind of the two cardinal rules right there.
Well, that's because it's a business for you guys, right?
We're trying to sell other artists' work. Don't come and bother us during gallery hours and hopefully, possibly, potentially representing so-called artist.
So if somebody's going to send work, is that how, I mean, how do they?
Well, nowadays it's gotten easier because now it's just sending us an email with a link to your website, resume, and a couple images. So in that respect, it's gotten so much easier than the earlier world as far as having to send slides and make it nice and print a nice resume. And as like you were saying, people putting in a fancy box or something like that. Those days are over. Now it's just submission on the tagline and your email, website.
How much stuff do you get that's not appropriate to the gallery?
98 to 99% of what is submitted to us is not a fit for the gallery.
And do you think that's just because people blanket stuff out, or do you think it's no research, or they're just hoping to God you guys might do something? They're trying to get an unemployment check. What do you think is the?
It's all of that. And just there's probably more artists than any of us want to believe that's out there. So realize any gallery that you're submitting to, there's hundreds, if not thousands of artists submitting to that gallery. And it would make artists' lives a lot easier if you did a little research yourself on the gallery, see if they show photography or mixed media, whatever you're trying to show, try to find a gallery that does seem to be a good fit.
I think for me, that's been one of probably the hardest parts for me is trying to find the right gallery for the right fit. Because there does seem, I mean, I think, you know, thinking like an artist, like, oh, if I can put my work in front of 100,000 people, it's 100,000 people who might say yes. And I think you get some thick skin as an artist to hear no. But at the same time, if you send 10 submissions to the 10 galleries where you're a good fit, you probably have a better chance of being picked up from a gallery standpoint than 100,000 random.
Yeah, and most artists do have somebody else in their support group that might be able to be that neutral party as far as even looking at other galleries. Because again, artists don't have that sometimes that separation of their work and reality.
Yeah, no, I think that's I think it's a very fair assessment.
So a lot of times if they have a friend or family member that could peruse a little bit and say like, oh my God, I think my husband could be a great fit in this gallery. A lot of times it's good to have kind of neutral eyes looking at.
But not overly supportive eyes where everything is amazing. My mom said I should be in your gallery.
Don't call mom.
I think one of the other things I've been so envious of is your position in the gallery, because it's given you access to so many other artists. For me, that I think, you know, I don't know if I've ever told you this, but I think that's one of my biggest struggles, because everybody thinks of me as someone as extroverted, but I'm actually relatively introverted in many ways. But to have access to getting in front of other artists, even if you're getting 100,000 submissions and they're not a right fit for you, you might see somebody in there where you're like, this doesn't fit in our gallery, but that's pretty cool.
Oh yeah. And, I see stuff that's cool to me all the time, but it's just a matter of if it's a right fit for the gallery. Cause I don't want to get the gallery in a situation. I don't want to get the artist in a situation, which is a very common occurrence as well, where sometimes the gallery will be like, oh my God, this stuff is cool. And then it just doesn't move. And then the gallery is bombed and the artist is bombed. And so that's part of it. You can do your own initial research and try to figure out that this looks like a gallery that could be a good fit for me. And that doesn't mean finding a gallery that has 20 other artists that look like you, you know. Yeah. I mean, which I think that's kind of one of the hard parts too for a lot of artists, to how does that work? It's like, I want a gallery that I'm a good fit in, but I don't want to be a gallery where there's 20 other artists doing the same thing that I'm kind of doing. So then you go for a gallery that doesn't, I'm the only one that does what, you know.
Yeah, I'm unique in my space.
Yeah, and you don't show anybody like me.
Yeah, yeah.
Typically a reason for that.
Yeah, yeah. If you're Andy Warhol, everybody loves you.
Hardest thing about our business is finding versus art that we think is going to sell and art that we think is meaningful or important to ourselves or to other people. So even for galleries, when they look at an artist's work, they think it might be potentially sellable, but they might be more personally interested in the work and excited about the work. But that doesn't mean it's going to necessarily appeal to the masses. And you don't have to always appeal to the masses. What you want to try to do in this field, if you're financially stable, maybe you can be a little more unique in what you do and what you show. If you're trying to make a living from it, I don't think it hurts to try to potentially think about what's sellable or appealing to the masses. It's kind of a tricky dialogue to go down with the artist.
That hard feedback for artists to hear, like, oh, you're creating something kind of cool, and last year you sold 20 pieces, well, but you're artists, creating that.
Yeah, no, it's typically more of a deterrent. If you say something that's more appealing to the masses, that's more of a deterrent to most artists than an attraction. I think art comes with that kind of punk rock mentality a lot of times, where it's more of trying to create the message, not think of the final outcome as far as the purchase or whatnot, but...
Yeah, I think that's the rough part for me too, is there comes a point where you do, and I don't think it matters who you are, you think about, is it sellable? Mm-hmm. You paint, you create stuff, you do all sorts of stuff. And, you know, at some point as the work starts to get done, you start to think like, can I sell this? And as we've talked, it ain't cheap to be an artist.
Right.
I mean, remove the fact you got to pay rent and all stuff on, but art supplies aren't cheap. Paint's not cheap. Cameras aren't cheap.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's, you know, you're trying to create something that's so meaningful for yourself. And then at the end of the day, you step back and you're like, huh, where can I put this that somebody will buy it so that I can buy more stuff to paint?
Yeah, I can't ever think of this word. So it's like the when you feel like it's worthy of something. If I sell something, then you're like, I am okay.
Yeah, I think it's probably self-worth. Your identity or whatever is tied up a little bit in the art.
There's some kind of word that I'm not.
Yeah, but I think there's an idea.
Once it's selling, it's just that is telling people that, yes, my work is worthy of somebody owning it, which is maybe not every artist's goal, but it sure feels good.
Well, yeah, it does feel good. Yeah, I mean, I think it'd be crazy to say there's not some ego tied up in the work.
It's not even ego so much as just like getting dressed in the morning and having somebody go, oh my God, that's a nice sweater. I'm like, fuck, I picked out a good sweater.
I trust myself and people like me. And of course, then I spilled coffee on it. But
what the hell is that word? Not exception. What's that like?
I don't know. I've always had that as like a self-identity or self-worth or reinforcement, recognition.
Yeah, recognition's close. That's what I'm thinking,
but. No, it is. I mean, I think that's probably a thought. Whatever that whatever your word you want to put there, and that self-worth, self-recognition. But I think for a lot of us, that's who create work. I think there's enough insecurity there that a little external validation.
Yeah, validation might be the word I'm looking for. That might be it.
Because I think there is a...
Because once somebody says, yes, I'll take it, it's that validation of feeling like you've done something that appeals to somebody else. And that's a hurdle that we're all trying to get over with art, in a sense, is just trying to find something that provokes some kind of emotion or conversation. And hope they want to take it home with them and continue that conversation. Because a lot of times you could walk into a gallery or a museum and the image will create that topic of conversation, but maybe not enough to want to take it home. It might be a photo of a bloody baby that that's going to create some conversation.
Yeah. Or you get it home and you realize that the conversation you have with the gallery was actually with the person at the gallery who knew something about art, and your friends don't know anything. And they're like, what the hell is that on your wall?
That doesn't matter so much. Because if the gallery can convince you into that, that's playing into your own mind, and meaning that there must have been, unless it's a really good salesperson, which isn't me. I'm just there to convince people of something that they actually personally love. I'm not trying to...
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, I think...
Push them on something that they might love. I'm going to push them on something that they're attracted to, that emotionally moves them somehow, be it a color or subject matter or topic or whatever.
Well, I think that's interesting, because I never, until you said this, I never really thought about this, but I think in that validation piece, that if, assuming a gallery is doing its job, and and you've told me this over the years, that don't ever buy a piece of art for investment, buy it because you love it.
Yeah.
And that as artists, you know, there is a love validation.
You might kick yourself on a couple that you pass by, but
but I think there is, in that validation role, there is a acceptance of who I am that somebody else validates through the purchase, makes it seem less crazy than it. Yeah.
Well, even you as a teacher, I mean, that's got to be, somebody takes a photo and they put it up there to do a crit. I don't know how that schooling stuff works, but maybe sometimes a teacher will be like, oh my God, this is an amazing photograph. Let's talk about it. And what that does for that photographer at that very second is like, holy, the teacher liked it. I mean, that's that validation of like, I took something else that caught somebody else's eye. So I think that's kind of the bottom line, I think, for all artists, art that's created. It's not if it sells or not so much, it's a matter of somebody is truly moved by it.
Yeah. Well, I think that's probably the hardest part of being an instructor in some ways, is that criticism of students or other people's work somewhat based on the level they're at. Because somebody who is brand new, has such enthusiasm for just the process, whether it's painting, sculpting, and their eye may not be, there's raw talent there, but it hasn't been honed to a level. And then there's, once you get better at it, the criticism may become more concise or may become more critical on some level because, as somebody who's been painting or photographing for X amount of time, or your raw talent now combined with some skill gets critiqued a little different than, wow, there's a lot of raw talent here,
yeah,
or there's a lot of skill here. It's now there's a expectation that both of those are coming together.
Yeah. Well, continued validation is as important, if not trickier, than that initial. A lot of times, including myself, I can hit it out of the park, or at least a double once, but you can't, as a photographer, any kind of artist, you can't just hit a double and be done. You got to be Edgar. Oh, no, you got to hit a lot of doubles.
Oh, no, there's a lot of Hall of Fame single double hitters.
It's got to be one really good image then.
One really important double.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think that is.
And those typically aren't doubles. Those are usually home runs, but one home run in your career. Yeah. It can put you on the map, but.
Yeah, but there's a difference, I think, today, because it's so competitive.
Yeah.
Where 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, one or two home runs might have built a career of an average artist, not a great artist. But today, a truly great artist may have to hit 50, 60, 70 and home runs.
None of us, maybe it's different with photography, but I don't think any of us want to be known for a single image. You know, you want to hopefully become known for, oh my God, I love everything this artist does. Yeah. Not, I love that piece that was on the cover of National Geographic or something like that, where it was just like, you get that one insane image that everybody oohs and ahs over. That doesn't make a career, that puts you on the map, but doesn't create a career.
And there's probably a, not having ever had that experience, but I would assume that probably would be a little almost sour.
Yeah.
To have that huge home run and then nothing after that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I think that's also one of the things that I find interesting too, is the artist who can stay kind of in the same medium over and over and over again and kind of revisit the same thing over and over again.
Yeah.
And then there's other artists who switch mediums, switch media, integrate media, you know, because I think about even my own work, you know, I mean, I love those historical processes, and, you know, it would be a lot easier for me to just be like, oh, I'm a digital color photographer. I'm not having to go read the 1867 Journal of British Photography trying to figure out why this thing doesn't work.
Yeah.
You know, but there is, you know, in that effort to not get stuck, you know, I find it interesting today that how many artists embrace multiple mediums, multiple formats, I think in an effort to, one, try to find their own identity, to find their niche, hit a home run, and have it be something that they can really love creating. Because at the end of the day, you know, like you said, whether we paint for ourselves at home or we paint for a gallery, there's value in what we do for ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah, no, in any creative process, you should be, I would hope, continuing to search and experiment and try different things. That's, I think, most great artists work in many different mediums until they find that one medium that clicks for them. And again, the masses, in a sense, you know, something that's going to appeal to multiple people other than just yourself. So a lot of times it is exploring a medium, be it printing process or papers or scale or what you're printing on or what you're painting on, every little aspect.
Well, that used to drive me crazy. I mean, you, in your art creation, used to drive me crazy. Like, you go take a photograph and you're like, oh, I'm going to print it on transparency. Then I'm going to put gold leaf on it. Then I'm going to put it under wax. Then I'm going to scratch it, burn it. Then I'm going to reconstitute it, pour it in a glass of water. I'm like, but why did you take a photograph then? Like, but yet that.
Yeah, well, some of us that aren't great photographers, we got to do everything we can to make it unique in some way.
Well, it's not just that. I just, you know, in my world, like, to have the thought, like, you can put that on top of a, like,
yeah,
you know, I think that's the other part about the art world that's amazing to me versus other industries. And I'm not saying there's not creative things in medicine and in finance and all that, but like the insatiable curiosity to see what happens if I take a tube of paint, a car tire, a nail, and this Barbie doll head.
Yeah.
I'll put that all together and see what happens. Like, it's just weird to me because I
know, and that sounds so cool.
Oh, I haven't shown you the loose sculpting I'm doing. Every time I find a tire on the side of the road, I go steal a Barbie doll.
Okay, sorry to break the flow of the interview, but we had a sort of catastrophe at this point in the interview. There was a lot of mayhem, dogs and cats living together. It was just completely chaotic. It was like peanut butter without jelly on sandwiches. Just totally crazy. So sorry for the break here. I've gone ahead and edited out all the chaos and mayhem, and we're picking back up. And I'm looking at my Twitter feed and commenting on a post by Peter Sosa about the Trump administration, and he's kind of baiting with an Obama photo. So anyway, we'll pick back up here. Sorry about that interruption.
So I just tweeted out that. So much people are just retweeting that interview I found.
He's had one of those great.
Yeah.
After Obama left, and he's now since.
Yeah, I don't know.
Gotten some time off that he's now able to start reposting and looking at his work.
I feel like I've just been looking at his work or something. Like, I don't know if it's just because of everything that's been on the computer right now.
Yeah, I think it's because he's been going back and revisiting his Instagram. He's been, you know, and all that stuff now is going into the archives for public viewing. So it's
I literally was just on a website and it must have been him, and it was showing his political photographs, and he was like Mr. Obama dude. And that was showing like his portraits and he shoots a lot of celebrities and all this other kind of stuff too. But I don't know how I ended up there if you didn't tell me how to get there. It's weird that.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, it would not surprise me.
Yeah, he is one of those too.
Because everywhere.
Yeah.
And I mean, and it's millions of photographs. I mean, 8 years.
Yeah.
12 years he's been following Obama in 8 years at the White House.
So. Yeah. Yeah, there's this great picture of him looking out the window with his big ears.
He has an iconic silhouette. Absolutely. I mean, that's one of those, like, you talk about a crazy job. You're basically in the president's hip walking around.
And just thinking about, like, some of the shit that's going down when you're taking some of these photos.
Oh, I know.
Just what your mind must be processing going, like, I can't believe I'm photographing Obama while we're killing Osama bin Laden.
Oh, yeah, that, you know, that, like, photograph from the
that's like,
from the Situation Room.
Yeah, you're like,
well, and that
I hope I'm not shaking too much.
Well, or the ones where it's just, you know, the president and his kids upstairs in the private residence.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I think it is a really kind of crazy piece. The thing about, you know, photography, I think that's so much, in some ways, cooler than the other art forms. You could be the sculptor for the White House and have some sculptures there, but documentary photography, the fine art, there's all these different ways
you're
that photography
is capturing moments of history.
And
which I think is, I'm hoping and wondering, that's what most photographers here are trying to literally capture a moment in time. You know, it's that beautiful snowy day or person getting shot in the head or whatever the hell it might be.
Well, according to Instagram today, there were 600,000 people photographing snowy days in Seattle.
I was one of them.
I took the best photograph of the snow. I saw some
big ass flakes out there. So yeah.
No, it is, but I think the piece for me that's been hard and exciting about photography is we're so inundated with images.
Absolutely.
And the thing I've shifted, I think, in my own thinking, which I don't know if it's the same. It's got to be the same. I mean, I don't follow enough depth of other art pieces, but photographs that are significant and meaningful versus good or bad. I want a photograph to be significant. I want to create significant, meaningful work. And I don't want to look at photographs. It's like, oh, that's a really great photograph of the sunset at the Grand Canyon that now literally looks like 100,000 other of the exact same photographs.
Right.
You know, and that, and not to make that sound like it's disparate against the people who photograph that, because you are there, you are in the moment, you are taking the picture. But, you know, I think about work that's in important work, whether it's paintings, sculpture that are lasting, you know, there's a significance to them.
Right.
You know, and I think it's interesting. I think that's an evolution for me over the years of, I always want to create a good photograph. And then, yeah, it was a photograph somebody would want on their wall.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's like, no, I want to create something that's actually significant. The whole thing of like, well, is that significant or not? Like, to who or whom? And
yeah, well, that goes back to the double, triple home run thing too. I mean, you think about most any artist, they're going to have that moonrise over Hernandez, that shot that puts them on the map. It's just a matter of then hopefully being able to create a voice from that one amazing image. There's always that, the famous shot of Muhammad Ali.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, like, it's one of the most iconic photographs in the world. That guy's got tons of amazing photographs. But that is the one that, like, brought people to his work, to see his other work, as was Adams and any artist for that part.
Yeah. I mean, there's always that, Warhol's stuff.
There's always something, the soup can. There's always something out there that kind of, hopefully initially we'll bring people in, and then it's just a matter of you trying to keep that power and strength and creativeness going and hope people find your other work as interesting as that one iconic shot or painting.
You think that's true for all types of artists, like sculptors, painters? Do you think it's the same across, or do you think, is there?
I think
about like professional sports, like you see that same competitive drive or that mm-hmm. same insecurity in all the professional athletes, whether they're mm-hmm. basketball, baseball, football, mm-hmm. hockey, tennis, women's, men's.
You know, it's that time that that running back breaks that first 60-yard run or mm-hmm. something that's like makes everybody go, oh, this guy's something special. So, I mean, I think that every artist, athlete, creative person, writer, whoever, you've got to have that first initial spark of something that people are going to react to in a positive or negative way.
And the artists you have around the gallery, do they come with the same insecurities?
Oh yeah.
Do they get pretty much the same? They're worried about stuff selling, or the people liking the work, no matter what, what's being shown.
And no matter how long they've had success, there's very few of them that take it for granted and know that every show is as scary as the first show.
What do you tell them to walk them off the ledge? Because I got Art Walk coming. I've seen some of them, so I know they're a little twitchy. But and I also know you, because you really connected with them. I mean, these are your friends, a lot of cases. Like, right.
Yeah, no, it's just kind of building up any of them, just like friends and whatnot, is giving them that validation of that you are good. Your work is going to be good. The show is going to be good. You know, because literally the most successful artists I know always have that insecurity of, how's my next show going to do?
Do you think they listen?
They listen with filtered ears for sure. Yeah, that's an artist thing for sure too.
Yeah. So I think about that. I mean, I don't know how it is for your work, but I think for my own work, there's such a weird filter. Not always. I mean, because sometimes my ego does get a little ahead of itself and I think I'm awesome, but other times it's like, that gets in the way. People I respect say, oh, this is amazing. And you're like, oh yeah, it's amazing for a 2-year-old with finger paints.
Yeah.
You know, is that.
You want the artist to have some kind of filter themselves as well, because you don't want them to literally hang on every, because we're not the all-knowing. We're only giving you our opinion of what we think our clients might respond to, but that's not the all-knowing answer of everything. Right. So there's always that, hopefully artists will listen to some of the criticism, but also never lose their own personal vision and creative thoughts. Because a lot of times, I mean, I love to be proven wrong by artists as well, where you're going down a great road, don't turn that way. And then they turn that way and they show it and it's like, oh my God.
Thank God you turned that way.
This is so much better than the other way. So there's always that too. So you can't stifle artists either. You never want to stifle creativity. Yeah. But I always feel like opinions are good and just try to take every little bit with a grain of salt.
Yeah. I always tell my people I work with, look for plausibility. That's my word. Like, is the feedback plausible? So it's not like somebody's blowing smoke and it's not so critical that it's, you know, you want to slit your wrist. Yeah. But like, if you heard the feedback, you're like, oh, I can see where that came back. One of the things I've always wanted to ask you, I don't think I ever have. So as a photographer, create a gallery body work book, you know, create this massive, because we have the ability to create work in some ways faster than other mediums, just because the medium is designed to be created faster.
Right.
As a painter, mixed media guy, if you were doing a show, obviously the gallery probably has a certain wall space you're looking at, and you're probably given some guidance there. And the gallery says they want X number of pieces, but how many pieces do you create? Like, if the gallery says you need, you're going to get 10 pieces and they're X size, how many pieces would you create to like feel comfortable about that? Is it, because as a photographer, you know, I would have, oh my God, to try to get to 10.
Right.
But as a painter or as a sculptor or mixed media.
Yeah. I mean, it depends on the scale of the gallery, but I think personally a body of work should be from 8 to 15 pieces. 15. Be it a photographer, painter, sculptor. I mean, something that creates some kind of storyline or voice or something like that. I mean, that's one of the things for me personally as a collector and dealer and viewer, is I like to see a cohesive enough body of work where I can see it's the same artist. I don't want every image to be so similar, but I want it to be able to look. And if that one is sold, I can say, that's okay. I love that piece too. So I think that's the part that a lot of artists struggle with, is trying to create a cohesive voice, tell a story, but also be different enough in each image. That's really one of the hardest things is.
So given that, where do you stand on artist statements or project statements? Like, does that make the work more interesting, less interesting? Does it depend on what they write?
Yeah, depends on.
Because I think some of the galleries.
For me, it depends on what you're looking at, not necessarily what you write. Because for me, a lot of times, if it's a photograph of a white wall, I, as a viewer, I'm like, wow, it's a white wall. And then I read the statement and I'm like, oh my God, it's, you know, they were born in a white room and they were locked up in a white room, or there's some kind of.
They escaped from the mental institution.
There's a meaning behind that white wall. So statements are important in that. Personally, I like the work to tell a story enough that I can figure it out myself. But statements can completely change your view on something. But for me personally, I prefer a body of work to make the statement, and then the statement be a thought or a view of what you were thinking while it was being created.
How often is it, do you think, you see in the either work that you guys get submitted, spaces you see where the statement and the work are disjointed enough where somebody here clearly knows how to write a statement, but the work's not there? Or yeah, you may have been born in a padded room, but I'm not really getting it. Like,
yeah, our,
because it seems
the work that I work with and deal with, that's typically not an issue. Our work is.
Yeah, but you go to a lot of galleries.
Yeah.
You look at a lot of work.
Yeah.
I've been there when you're like, what's up with that?
Yeah.
Do you think that turns off the work at all?
No. I mean, I think it depends on the viewer and the work. I mean, some people, the beauty of art and the beauty of collecting art and viewing art is it's so completely subjective. So there's, I think for art critics, they love a good artist statement. That's like, sometimes that is way more important than
work,
the actual image and work that they're viewing. It's like they look up and see the white wall and go, huh, I wonder what this artist was thinking. Then they read the statement like, oh my God, this is amazing. Or me, I just see the white wall and then I read the statement. I'm like, okay, that makes a little more sense to me. Yeah. So I think art critics really love often the story behind the art more than what the art is actually physically saying.
Another question I've always pondered to ask you, because you do get to visit and you do have so many artist friends where you visit their studios and all that. I've got certain photographer friends who won't hang their own photographs. They're like, I don't need to see my own work. I don't need to be inspired by my own work. Why would I ever look at it? Mm-hmm. And then I go to other places where they're actual removing people who have galleries attached to their studios, but they have their own work up.
Yeah.
Kind of what's your take on that? For, is that just, do you think varies by person? Do you see a certain type of artist?
I think that's completely personal and subjective. Again, I've got some of my best friend artists who don't hang their own art or any art. I'm like,
well, they have the blank white wall.
They have the blank white walls, or they just have stuff hanging and it's just not important to them to have any kind of, I guess, visual inspiration for them. They're more in
an empty space gives them their.
Yeah.
Yeah. Lori talked about that in her interview that her goal is to create emptiness.
Yeah.
So that she has space to fill with what she's creating.
I think one of the, you know, for a lot of artists, there's financially, a lot of them don't have the resources to collect a lot of art out of a gallery. They might be doing trade with other artists and whatnot. So you might not be necessarily even ending up with what your dream piece. But I always encourage artists to collect, look at other artists' work, be inspired by other artists' work. For me, that's personally huge, but it's definitely not for all artists. Some artists just want to not have that visual distraction all the time and not look up at a photograph or a painting and think or wonder why they're not painting like that or want to even be inspired by that kind of work. So,
do you get inspired by all the work in your house? Like, is that a...
Yes and no. Yes and no. I mean, a lot of the artists that I've collected, I admire their work. I'm in a business where, being a creative person myself, I definitely am influenced by my visual surroundings.
Yeah.
But I don't want to do that. I mean, it's one of the reasons I've shied away from trying to paint or be creative while I'm in this industry, because I don't want to be somebody else.
Yeah,
you want to have my own voice, and it's hard. It's hard to have your own voice when you're surrounded by other amazing voices. Like, damn. So,
I think that's one of the interesting traps that I do think to become really great at your craft and your art, you have to immerse yourself into that space, because you need to be around other creative minded people. You need to have the safety of other like-minded people, and even if they don't understand the work, like you said, they're your friends and they're able to give you an objective eye and all that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, and I think there's a point where you get so enamored with the work around you that's inspiring you that you start to fear that you are losing your own voice. Mm-hmm. But yet at the same time, you need to be around that inspiration to really understand great painting. You need to look at master painters to understand great poets. You need to read poetry. There's a rawness to creating things, I think, but I think you get better at understanding why you may be creating that or how you're relating to the work when you're around other types of art. And it's a weird balance to walk. Mm-hmm. The quote I have on my computer is inspiration, not imitation.
Right.
And absolutely. It's so hard. Like, you take a photograph. For me, I take a photograph and I'm like, oh, that's a Eggleston photograph. That's an Adams photograph. And then every once in a while, I just hope to God there's a Daniel photograph.
Yeah.
Photograph in there. Cause I think that is.
Yeah. There's nothing zero wrong with being inspired and influenced by another artist, but to emulate another artist typically is not the route most of us want to go. But sometimes it's hard not to be completely overly taken by a certain form of imagery that just overtakes you and you become a secondhand version of that.
We've argued this many times, but the value of a formal education in art.
Do I believe it's
valuable?
Valuable? No. Yeah. No, I think it could be a deterrent sometimes more than something that can help you. Photography might be a little different.
I have some philosophical issues, particularly where the MFA, some of the MFA, not all, but some MFA programs create kind of clones of the professors. Mm-hmm. Can you kind of see that there's in the stuff you look at where it's like, oh, this is definitely a LA influence piece versus New York, or is the artist you're working with, they're just distinct enough that you don't notice that?
I don't notice that personally, but I mean, I think most of my artists with MFAs, I think they almost get to that point too of trying too hard to be something, where a creative process is really about what's inside you. So I think that a lot of times a teacher telling you what's wrong or right compositionally, color wise or whatnot, I don't feel is always the best thing for an artist.
Well, I mean, sometimes people use the wrong color, Eric.
That's what makes that piece so genius too.
That makes me nauseous.
Yeah, that's you break those rules just right.
No, that color should not exist for a reason.
Tree right in the damn center of that photo, or yeah, make that hot pink and you think it's the most disgusting thing, and next thing you know, that's the one that makes you famous.
I don't need to see T-Mobile pink in any of my art.
You got some teacher telling you never use a tree right in the center with hot pink sky.
It's true.
Never did you realize that was going to be your moneymaker, because you broke all the damn rules.
And you better hope to God you love it, because if it's your moneymaker,
creative voice.
You better hope to God it's true to you, though, because for the rest of your life, you're gonna sing that one hit wonder. Yep. You're going to be like, if I have to do another tree with a hot pink sky, somebody's dying tonight. You think about those poor cover band, those opening bands who get to go out and play that one song that everybody knows.
Hey, they're still at Emerald Casino.
No, those aren't the one-hit wonder bands. Those are just the bands that were around when we were kids. We're just old now.
Yeah.
Somebody who's not got a gallery representation, not got somebody to work with. And what would be, if you're going to give a couple of pieces, a piece of advice, talk about a couple of things that not to do with the gallery. Don't show up during business hours. Don't call during business hours. We've talked a lot about that, being true to yourself as an artist and finding your right place. But for somebody who's kind of feeling like they want to be there, but they just can't get there, what would you tell them? Or what would you tell one of your friends who's stuck there?
Kind of just regurgitating what we've already said. It's doing the research, basically, and not being disappointed when you get way more no's and yeses, unless you're just super kick-ass rock star, then you don't have to worry about listening to this podcast.
You're still probably getting a lot of no's.
Yeah.
You just don't tell anybody. It's like going to Vegas.
Yeah.
Everybody's a winner.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's $40 billion casino. Yeah. Yeah. It was built on the profits of all of the winners.
Yeah. No, I just keep sending, keep doing your research before you send it, but don't ever stop. Try other cities, towns, different kinds of venues. You know, I think a lot of times artists feel they need to go right into the gallery circuit, and I don't recommend that either. I think as a beginning artist, any kind of alternative space is a great way to start. So be it a coffee shop or retail shop or an alternative pop-up gallery space. I think those are all great starts for an artist just to see what their own work looks like hanging and as a body of work. But you're always going to get turned down. Well, a lot of us are going to get turned down more than not. Yeah. So you just got to keep and not resubmitting the same imagery.
Yeah.
You got to understand yourself as an artist as well, that if you've submitted to 500 galleries and they've all said no,
might be time for some new work.
Yeah. There still might be that gallery out there,
but you might be better.
You might start thinking about another body of work. Yeah. So that's the other thing, I guess, is just not to, you might feel like you've really found something that clicks, and if you want to stick with it forever and hope to find that, because that could still be your magic in the bottle. Yeah. But I think to never stop exploring as a photographer or any kind of creative artist, you got to always try different mediums, tweak the medium that you're doing.
Is that kind of how you... I mean, because I noticed you over the years have switched mediums and tried different things. Is that part of your...
Well, for me, it's more this that...
Looking for what is your...
Looking for the voice. Yeah. And trying to find something that I can be cohesive and consistent at. Like I've said, I've taken plenty of photos that I thought were kind of interesting, or I'm painting a couple of paintings I thought were interesting, but to be able to then create a body from that image has always been the
tree with the pink sky. You can only make so many of those, Eric.
That's right.
People start to think I've already seen this pink sky. Well, Eric, thanks for spending some time with us today. I really appreciate you talking about kind of the gallery and that space and what that looks like. I know for a lot of people, it's such a foreign space for them. And I think it's really great that you've been willing to talk a little bit about that and your experience of working with other artists and how our consistency in a community to all of us that we can find ways of supporting, whether it's a photographer, a sculptor, a painter, no matter what you are, there's an opportunity for you to kind of really find a community of support and really work through that. So I appreciate you taking some time to do that today.
Yeah. And thank you for trying to put the voice out there and continue the conversation with artists. And I think that's a great thing. So
thanks.
Thank you.
So don't forget, you can always find us up on iTunes and subscribe there, or you can find us up on the web at www.theperceptivephotographer.com. We still got a couple other interviews this month, so don't forget to tune in for those. Or if you missed any ones earlier in the month, you can find those up on iTunes. Have a great week behind the camera, and I will see you next time.